as Jim Ingram with the Chronicle-Telegram, the Medina Gazette, and a special contributor to Forbes joins us right now. Jim, always a pleasure to have you on the show, and well, I want to get into the 10 games that you detailed just a couple of days ago. You did some really interesting research, and you found 10 games in particular, and I want to begin with the number one on your list, Game 5 of the 1920 World Series. Jim, in putting this article together, what made this game so compelling?
Well, the Indians were in the World Series. That's one thing that didn't happen very often for several years. And they actually won this one, which has only been done one other time in the history of the World Series and the Indians. So that was made it kind of unique. But in that specific game, Game 5, you had the first unassisted triple play in World Series history by Bill Wamgantz, the Indian second baseman. And then you had Indians right fielder Elmer Flick hitting a grand slam home run, the first grand slam in World Series history. And then the Indians pitcher Jim Bagby hit a home run, and that was the first time a pitcher had ever hit a home run in the World Series. And the Indians won also, so if you were an Indians fan and you happened to be at League Park on that day, that was a pretty exciting day for you.
And here we are 100 years later. We're hopeful that we'll get some kind of baseball in some way, shape, or form. But, you know, I want to go to another one that stood out to me on your list. It was October 4th, 1948. Now, everybody knows the Indians went the distance that year, won it all, but it was the way in which they won the pennant over the Red Sox, which was really interesting. You know, in examining that game, Jim, what were some of the highlights along the way and what made this so interesting?
Well, it ended up in the Indians and Red Sox ended up tied for first place in the American League at the end of the season. And of course, there was no playoff ALCS or division series round or anything. It was just the two first-place teams in the National League and the American League played each other for the World Series. But because of this tie between the Indians and Red Sox, they had to play a one-game playoff. It was just a one-game playoff, and it was played up in Boston. And the Indians ended up winning 8-3, but the bigger story, I think, was this was the year that Lou Boudreau, the Indians' player manager, by the way, who took over as player manager when he was 24 years old, which I don't think we'll ever see that again. But in that game, that playoff game against Boston, he went 4-for-4 and hit two home runs, and they just got off to a real. The first home run was right in the very first inning and gave him a lead that they never gave up. And I believe Gene Bearden was the Indians' pitcher, and I think he went the whole way in that game. So then they beat the Red Sox to win the pennant in Fenway Park, this was. And then they beat Boston's other team, the Boston Braves, in the World Series to win the World Series. So that was about as good as it gets for Cleveland versus Boston if you're a Cleveland fan.
Yeah, Cleveland beating up on Boston. That seemed to be quite the trend back in 1948. Jim, obviously, you know, a whole list here, and I'm sure you'd find a reason to go to pretty much every single one of these games. But of those other eight games that we haven't mentioned yet, if you could only pick two of those to attend, which ones would you pick and why?
I would probably pick Bob Feller's game. It was his fourth major league start, and he was 17 years old. And it came against the Philadelphia A's. So it was his fourth major league start, and you look partially at his pitching line that day, and it doesn't look that impressive. He walked nine batters and hit another batter. But he also struck out 17, which tied the major league record set by Dizzy Dean. And that's pretty amazing in itself that a 17-year-old kid that could come up to the big leagues and set a major league record, tie the major league record for strikeouts at that time. But I think what a lot of people don't realize is Feller pitched, I think he had about 10 or 12 appearances in that 1936 season. And after the season, he went back to Iowa to begin his senior year of high school. So basically, he tied a major league record as a high school junior, which I don't think we'll ever see again. Also, I always thought that, I mean, if LeBron, this Bob Feller was kind of like the baseball LeBron of his day, but without the gigantic media coverage that sports have nowadays. I mean, if someone, if you think about it today, if there was like a junior in high school, a pitcher came up to the big leagues and tied a major league record for strikeouts in a game, this would be like gigantic story all over the country for multiple years, I would think. But I mean, Feller did this in relative obscurity. I mean, I'm not sure. I'm sure he got pretty good play at the time, but that's just a staggering achievement for me. And the fact that he wasn't even out of high school and he's tying a major league record, so that would be one of them. And I think I'd probably, for the other one, I guess I might have to go with Eddie Jauss's perfect game in 1908, which came in the heat of a pennant race between the Indians and the White Sox and the Tigers. It was only the second perfect game in the history of the American League, and this was in 1908. And he was pitching. They were playing the White Sox, who were they were one game ahead of the White Sox. The White Sox were in third place. The Indians were a game ahead of them in second, and the Indians were only a half game behind Detroit for first place. And this was with only about, I think, 10 games left in the season. So it was a hugely important game for the Indians and the White Sox. And the White Sox pitcher was Big Ed Walsh, who eventually became a Hall of Famer. And Jauss pitches this perfect game, and they win the game 1-0. And Big Ed Walsh, for the White Sox pitcher, he pitched a four-hitter and struck out 15, but lost. And wow. You know, Jauss got the perfect game. And the most amazing thing about his perfect game was it was 74 pitches, which is pretty stunning for any era, but back then, 100. And I looked up, I think the time of the game was like an hour and 40 minutes, which seems impossible to us in the modern day now. But that was a really important game for the Indians, and a spectacularly pitched game in a clutch situation for Eddie Jauss, who unfortunately died in 1911 of tubercular meningitis, I think it was. And just, he was at the peak of his career and probably would have set all kinds of records, Indians records for sure, but never got to finish out his career. But that was another one that was at League Park, and a lot of historic things happened back at that old ballpark, but that was one of the most memorable ones, I would say.
Wow. You're right, just how incredibly different. I mean, just over 70 pitches to toss a perfect game in a game that took just over an hour and a half. Just remarkable stuff. Again, we're being joined to the hotline by Jim Ingram with the Chronicle-Telegram, the Medina Gazette, and a special contributor to Forbes. Boy, Jim, I've got to ask you about another game on here. August 2nd, 1925, and a strikeout doesn't normally make news, but in this case, it did, because it involved a player that hadn't struck out in over 2 months.
yeah, that was Joe Sewell, the Indians shortstop. And, one of the things that's happened over the years in baseball is, strikeouts mean nothing nowadays. In fact, teams are willing to live with strikeouts if the player will hit enough home runs to cancel out all those strikeouts. But back for most of baseball's history, and especially back in the 20s, this game was in 1925, strikeouts was like a badge of honor or an embarrassment to a hitter. I mean, they did anything to avoid striking out. I mean, home runs weren't that big of a deal, until Babe Ruth came into the game. But for the most part, most players just, choked up on the bat and tried to get on base any way they could, bunting or hitting a single or hit and running or stuff like that. But so strikeouts, it was very rare, but not for all hitters, but especially for Joe Sewell, who literally almost never struck out. In this game, he struck out, it was August 2nd, 1925. And so it's August 2nd, and he hadn't struck out since May 30th, which was 290 plate appearances ago. And he only struck out four times that entire season. In fact, I went back and counted in the 2019 Major League season, the one we just had last year, there were 100 Major League hitters that struck out 115 times last year. And Joe Sewell struck out 114 times in his entire 14-year career. So when he struck out, I don't know what the reaction was that day, but I would imagine everyone was shocked that happened.
That really is amazing. And you put this in your article as well, that he struck out an average of 5 times per season.
Yeah.
That's remarkable. Just
yeah.
remarkable.
You get guys that strike out 5 times in a doubleheader or 10 times in 1 week probably. But, back then, he was the extreme in that case. He was, I think, probably struck out. I don't know if this for a fact, but I would imagine if you looked at his strikeouts per batter, per plate appearances, has to be the best, or close to being the best in Major League history, because he just always put the bat on the ball. He actually batted 4th, and I think the year we're talking about here, I think he only hit like 5 home runs. But how many hitters have the same number of home runs as strikeouts in one season? That's probably pretty rare too.
Oh, extraordinarily rare, especially these days. And I thought that was an interesting comparison, too, talking about the number of hitters last year that struck out at least 115 times. Compare that to that 14-year Major League career where Sewell struck out 114 times. That's nuts. And to bring this thing full circle, right back to today's game, Jim, and I think we're all kind of sitting on pins and needles here, wondering when they're going to get going, if they're going to get going again here in 2020. You've seen and you've heard a lot of these rumors about if and when they might be able to get things going again. Which of these do you think makes the most sense, or maybe are the most believable at this point?
Well, that's a good question. I find it, I don't know. Everyone's trying to make predictions on something that is totally unpredictable and will be probably at least for another month or two. So I don't know which one. I mean, there's so much stuff being thrown against the wall now. It's hard to keep track of them all. I suppose the one that seems to still be foremost in a lot of people's minds is the one where they go to Florida and or Arizona and play games in empty spring training facilities and or maybe major league parks and then go that route, but I don't know. I mean, I don't think anybody can say with any degree of certainty which one of these scenarios is going to play out, or when the time frame will be for all of those things. I mean, obviously, we all hope it's sooner rather than later. But you know, when you're dealing with what we're dealing with, this health crisis we're in, it's difficult to predict the future. And I don't think any of the sports that are currently not underway right now have no idea not only when that they're going to be able to start, but when they're even going to be able to say anything definitively about any kind of timetable for starting. So I would say if you ask me now, I would say I suppose the one where they start in Florida and Arizona with no fans, maybe that would be the more likely scenario right now. But you know, who knows when that will even be. I mean, there's so many caveats to each of these scenarios that there's just a lot of sorting out to do, and I think everyone is reaching the point now where they're so anxious to see sports that you know it's almost like a sport. It's almost like become a game now to kind of predict in what form and when all this is going to happen. When really even the wisest of all of us out here, you know, including the medical people and the people that run all these sports, don't really know for sure, but you know, they feel obligated to kind of give some vague ideas of when this is going to happen. So I don't know. It's hard to be patient when you're missing all of your sports. This is pretty much unprecedented for this country, and it's a lot of people waiting for a lot of sports to begin. And until we get closer to whenever that is, and I don't even think we know when that will be, I think it's I'm not sure what purpose it serves to even speculate about it, other than the fact that it's going to be a while, and when we get closer, you know, we'll find out. But it doesn't seem like it's around the corner at this point.
Well, as you told me before we came on the air here, this is something we haven't experienced in a very long time. For most of us, this is the only time we will experience this. And as you so promptly put it at the very end of that statement, well, one's more than enough for me. I hope we never have to experience anything like this ever again, because it is clearly weighing on us all. Jim, as always, we appreciate the time. Thank you so much for stopping by. And hopefully the next time we have you on, we have some definitive baseball dates to talk about.
That would be great. Thanks a lot, Andy.
Thank you, Jim. Again, that's Jim Ingram with the Chronicle-Telegram, the Medina Gazette, and, of course, a special contributor to Forbes as well. We implore you to check out that article Jim wrote. You can check it out at chronicleT.com. It was a really interesting mix of games. 10 in Indians history that you won't see replayed on TV anytime soon because, again, they happened so long ago that TV either wasn't around or TV wasn't readily available, but boy, how about some of the games he dug up there? Some really good stuff.